Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Jonathan R. Latham, Ph.D. He's co-founder and executive director of the Bioscience Resource Project and the editor of Independent Science News. He's also the director of the Poison Papers Project, which publicizes documents of the chemical industry and its regulators. Dr. Latham holds a master's degree in crop genetics and a Ph.D. in virology. He was subsequently a postdoctoral research associate in the Department of Genetics, University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's published scientific papers in disciplines as diverse as plant ecology, plant virology, genetics, and genetic engineering. Dr. Latham talks frequently at international events and scientific and regulatory conferences on the research conducted by the project. He's written for Truthout, MIT Technology Review, The Guardian, Resilience, and many other magazines and websites. Today we talk about genetically modified organisms. So first off, thank you for your work, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Hi there, Derek. It's a pleasure.
So what is genetic modification and what are GMOs? Let's start with that.
Well, the easiest way to answer that question probably is a simple idea that genetic modification, as in a biotech sense, is the moving of pieces of DNA from one species to another one. And there are different ways of doing that. You can use particles to attach the DNA to and then shoot those into cells, or you can use bacteria to transfer the DNA. And the end result is approximately similar in that, you know, if you, you know, from the many, many versions that end up being created by the mechanism of production of those plants, you can choose ones that most closely resemble the result that you want, which is to attempt to introduce one single piece of DNA and one kind of genetic construct into the resulting plant. And that is what most people mean by genetic modification. So, you know, we used to call it plant transformation, which is a kind of hubristic use of those words. But that means, you know, what you're trying to imply with genetic transformation is that, you know, you've made some fundamental radical difference to that organism by inserting the DNA. What the term genetic modification or genetic engineering, these are kind of more modern terms that are used in public that have kind of connotations. You know, they have metaphors to do with engineering or metaphors to do with, you know, we're only making a small change here and no need to worry about that. So there are all these words, but essentially what's mostly been done is to bring pieces of DNA that are basically assembled from all kinds of other pieces of DNA, and we can go into that if you wish, that essentially come from different species. So a typical transgene will have a piece of DNA from a virus and a piece of DNA from a bacterium and a piece of DNA from another bacterium and maybe something from a different plant species, and it will be assembled together by a molecular biologist, and then that is what is shot into the cells and used to create the new variety. So that gives you some idea of what is going on here, at least.
And why, apart from this culture's desire to control nature and to mm-hmm. basically mess up everything there is, apart from that, a better way to say this, what is the stated motivation for doing this sort of transformation or modification? What are they hoping to accomplish?
Yeah, I mean, probably listeners will be familiar with these stated motivations, right? They are to in part to create profits for biotech companies, and in part to produce more better yielding crops or crops that resist disease or to reduce pesticide use. So there are all these stated, you know, purposes of these modifications. But, you know, what's interesting really is the unstated ones that have come much closer to the truth.
And do you want to go on about those for a moment? And then we'll come back and hit some other issues in a moment. But why don't you talk about the unstated ones?
Yeah, sure. So the you know, hardly ever stated in public, at least. You know, one of them, arguably the most important, is intellectual property, right? If you take a piece of DNA that you've patented and then you put it into a crop variety, you know, a soybean or a maize or a cotton variety, you become the owner of that seed, right? You become the person who can not only own the intellectual property associated with that seed, but also you can demonstrate that in court, right? Because you've taken a piece of DNA that you have a test for. And so you can basically go to the farmer who you suspect has grown your crop and tell them that, you know, you have this little piece of paper and a definitive scientific test that proves that they stole your intellectual property. And no one's going to argue with that technical feat that you've done. So this is, in my opinion, the one of the most fundamental drivers of this. The other is that, you know, look who's taken over the seed industry, right? With that intellectual property power, who's taken over the seed industry is the chemical industry, right? Monsanto now is the owner of a huge proportion of the U.S. and global seed industry. So is Dow. So is DuPont before they merge. So, and BASF, right? These are all chemical companies. Why are they taking over the seed industry? Because they can sell more chemicals, right? They don't want other people to tell farmers and dictate to farmers what they do with, on their field. They want to be driving the system in a direction that increases pesticide use, and that's indeed what's happened.
So this is fundamentally different than farming has been for forever, where if you give me some, or I buy from you, some turnip seeds, or I buy from you some sunflower seeds, and then I grow plants, and then I collect them. You know, we can talk about whether, whether somebody actually owns anything, owns another being, but we'll leave that aside for a moment. And so I can then replant my turnips or sunflowers, and I have control of them. And what you're saying now is that if I were to do that, you could sue me because you actually own that genetic line. Is that correct?
Yep. I mean, it's worth going a little bit into the history of seed breeding. Originally, varieties were created by farmers. You know, each farmer saved their own seed and replanted it the next year, and they would save the best seed from that crop, and they would then replant those. And maybe they'd share them with their neighbors. Maybe they would, take them to some foreign part that they went to. It's not even clear that there would have been financial exchanges involved in all that. So, but then in about the mid-19th century, the crop, basically, breeders realized there was a business model for them if they could breed true lines, like very narrowly genetically based lines, and then they could basically sell varieties with special traits. And so the seed industry grew up based around these special traits and these inbred lines. What happened in the 1940s and 50s is that hybrid seeds became available, and you'll see that the seed breeding industry became concentrated around crops that you could grow, that could be made hybrids. And the purpose of hybrids was to stop farmers from saving seeds, because if you save the seeds of hybrids, they don't breed true, right? That means that the seed has relatively little value when it's saved. And so what you see is successively the seed industry builds up around a set of steps which involve making life difficult for farmers who want to merely save the seed as they've done for 10,000 years. And genetic modification, GMOs, are another step along this train of thought, if you like.
So this is a slightly different subject. Something I've read in the newspaper more times than I want to think about is someone says, humans have been doing genetic modification for as long as they've been doing selective breeding. And in fact, nature has been doing genetic modification forever, because that's just reproduction. Before we actually say there, before I let you respond, I want to say one thing, which is that it seems to me that if potatoes and octopus wanted to mix their genes, they would find a way to have sex. And so that argument has always seemed disingenuous to me, but I'm wondering if you can help me understand more why it's disingenuous, if you believe it is.
Yeah. Well, it is disingenuous in that, you know, genetic modification, the whole reason it was patented was that, you know, the procedure, not just the individual product, is that it is a radical departure to extract DNA from one species, to mix and match it with all these pieces of DNA from other species, and then to put it onto a pellet or put it into a bacterium, and then take that pellet and that bacterium and apply them to a cell culture, right? And then have that cell culture grow up and become a plant, an individual plant that has pollen and seeds and roots and so forth, right? That is a very radical, you know, in many, many ways, is a very radical departure from what goes on when you cross one tomato variety with another one. And so, you know, to call this procedure genetic modification was a sleight of hand. Right, like I said, we called it plant transformation when I was a molecular biologist, you know, when I was doing that academic stuff. We called it by a name that's at least a little bit, you know, like I said, it's hubristic, but it's a little bit closer to the reality in that you're making potentially radical changes to those organisms. And so, but once the biotech industry has settled on the term genetic modification, well, genetic modification is just a word that, you know, kind of implies, well, just that anything could be going on here, right? And so when people say, well, we've been doing genetic modification forever, all they're doing is moving the goalposts. They're changing the definition of that word from something that specifically legally applies to GMOs to using it as a term that, you know, because it's so sort of bland and meaningless, can in principle be applied to anything. So what's going on between, you know, when a tomato crosses with another tomato or a potato crosses with another potato is fundamentally, you know, that is still part of the breeding process. It still is used even for genetic modification. You still have to go through those kinds of processes in order to develop your final crop. But it is radically different. But we don't, you know, in many ways, what's interesting about crossing tomato with a tomato is we don't really know what goes on inside that tomato plant in order to produce its offspring. Even today, you know, that process is quite mysterious.
By which you mean the process of sexual reproduction?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, another thing that we hear quite often is that I've read this in the newspaper many, many times too, is that the debate over the safety of genetically modified organisms is done. And anyone who does not believe that GMOs are safe for humans and for the natural world is just plain ignorant and unwilling to, and is basically just being skeptical on principle as opposed to having any evidence to support that whatsoever.
Yeah. So, you know, firstly, science, you know, this is a misconception of what science is all about, right? Science is about questioning things. You know, when Albert Einstein came up with his theory of relativity and all his theoretical innovations around that, you know, physicists would have said the exact same thing, right? In quite likely. And so the whole principle of science is that the concepts and the meaning of the experiments that have been done up to that day are, you know, basically open for interpretation. One of the favorite quotes that I like about science is a belief in the ignorance of experts, right? And the point about that is that you wouldn't do science. You wouldn't enter the career of science. You wouldn't become a scientist if you didn't believe that the people who came before you were quite likely to be wrong in what they thought. Because otherwise, you'd just be kind of adding details and, you know, pretty meaningless bits of information to the scientific canon, if you like. And so there is no, to me, there is no meaning to those kinds of statements. These are people who are deliberately attempting to sort of corral and make science into a sort of religious dogma, which is totally inappropriate to the study of the natural world. So there is, the statement is wrong on that level. The statement is also wrong on the level of what is the actual, you know, the technical level of what is the actual scientific evidence to support concerns about GMOs. I've just been on tour in Australia, and I gave a presentation alongside a woman called Judy Carman, and she's been doing animal experiments in which she's been feeding GMO crops to pigs and also to rats, and she has been showing that if you feed non-GMO and GMO foods to these animals, the ones fed the GMO foods do much worse health-wise. They have inflamed intestines, they have health problems of various kinds. And so she's doing experiments that basically no one else has bothered to do, right? The biotech industry doesn't want those kinds of experiments done. And we have, you know, when I was in Australia, part of the reason for me being there was that we have done some analysis on some of the proteins that are used in GMO crops. So there's these proteins called cry toxins. They're sometimes called BT toxins, and they're put into crops that are called, sometimes called BT crops. The BT stands for Bacillus thuringiensis, and it's a bacterium that basically kills insects. And what the biotech industry has done is taken a whole load of these toxins and put them into crops and use those, and when the toxin is in the crop, then that crop kills insects that feed on the crop. And what this toxin does is it basically make holes in membranes. And your gut is lined by membranes. The insect's gut is lined by membranes. What happens to those insects is the toxin makes a hole in the membrane. When it makes a hole in the membrane, the cell bursts, the surface cells of the gut burst. And the insect is eaten alive, basically, by the bacteria that exist inside its stomach. So they can basically migrate out of the stomach and into the bloodstream and so forth. So the insect dies, stops feeding basically straight away, and then it dies. So the question then for the biotech industry and for the regulators and the people who assure us that these GMOs are safe is to come up with a logical explanation. Since we all have these gut membranes, why these toxins are active against insects but not against people? Because that is their claim, right? But like I said, they're not actually doing the experiments, right? They're not doing the experiments that would actually test. It would give people these crops. They give animals under sensible scientific conditions these crops. And so what they're doing is they're coming up with all these hand-waving explanations of why these toxins don't make holes in your gut, but why they're killing these insects. And basically what we showed is that these hand-waving explanations of why there's no harm to these, to harm the results from the food you eat containing these toxins, those hand-waving explanations are scientifically extremely weak. And so what's interesting about the Judy Carman's research is that she is showing scientific evidence of exactly the kind of harm that you would predict based on the analysis that we did. And so it was very interesting that we were giving talks in the same venue and talking together, because, you know, there's a perfect tie-up between what we are saying about the standard arguments of GMOs and that everybody says is settled and her research results. So the bottom line here is that there are theoretical reasons why you should be concerned about the kind of changes that Monsanto and Dow and Syngenta and BASF are making to these crops. And then there are, Judy Carman is an independent researcher, and she's not interested in making false claims about GMOs. This is a serious question, and she has evidence that bad things happen to the intestines of animals that eat these crops. So you put those two things together and you don't have a settled question at all. You have a whole series of profound doubts.
So it sounds like what is being suggested by these experiments is that the BT is not is not insect specific in terms of causing harm to
And this has implications too for, you know, other insects that are affected by, you know, the pollen from GMO crops, for example, blows across the countryside. The roots of the crops are left in the soil at the end of the year. The tops of the crops go into the rivers and lakes and estuaries and so forth. So sorry to interrupt you, but yeah, no, that's your description of it is scientifically precise. Yeah.
And this, I don't know the answer to this at all. What happens to the birds who eat the insects who have been who are in the process of dying? Can it cross those? I mean, that happens with of course DDT. That happens with lots of pesticides that end up sort of bioaccumulating. Does the BT at some point self-destruct, or does it continue to sort of ramify through the natural community?
Yeah. So that's a good question. And so far as I know, nobody has ever asked that question.
See, this is the thing that really makes me, 30 years ago I was upset about this, that it seems to me that one of the stupidest things that anyone could do is to perform open-air experiments with potentially significantly harmful consequences. It's like you can, it's bad enough that you know, the people are going to mess around in labs, and I mean the arrogance of doing an open air experiment. They don't care whether we're talking about biodiversity crash, plastic in the oceans, global warming, GMOs. It just seems like a fundamentally bad idea. Oh, there's a line from the Bhopal catastrophe. Afterwards, there was one of the activists who was trying to help people said, "You should not be allowed to make a poison for which there is no antidote." And that's like the smartest thing I think anyone has ever said in the history of human beings. Anyway, so I'm done rambling. So please take that anywhere you want.
That's a perfectly good statement, right? We need to ask some very basic questions about what we're doing here. You know, this you know, experiment in, and it is an experiment, in, you know, giving people genetically engineered foods and putting these things out onto landscapes and having them reproduce, you know, in the wild, some of them. You know, not maize doesn't necessarily reproduce in the northern United States, but many of these crops do spread. They reproduce. They mate with wild relatives. The transgenes move out into the environment. They don't necessarily biodegrade. The toxin, as you were saying, the toxin from these plants does go into, in certain cases, and maybe in every case, the organisms that eat the worms, for example, that eat the corn. So they move through the food chain. And they are, you know, in part they're biodegraded. You can say that with bare amount of certainty. But the problem is they're produced in such enormous quantities that even if they're 90% biodegraded 90% of the time, that doesn't mean that they're not causing a vast amount of trouble for ecosystems, right? So for example, somebody asked this question only 10 years ago, right? The very first person asked the question, what happens when these toxins go into streams and rivers? And they took one species of caddisfly, and they fed that caddisfly on GMO crop debris containing these toxins. And guess what happens? The caddisflies die. So that's the very first species that they tried. Nobody before that point had even thought to ask the question, what happens when these things move into streams? But we know they do move into streams. Like I said, they've been found in estuaries hundreds of miles away from where these crops are actually grown, right? So these toxins are moving entirely, you know, through ecosystems in ways that we, you know, barely understand, but secondly, without, you know, even remotely adequate testing. And so all of what you say is absolutely true. And so, you know, and that is the basis of the kind of analysis that we published that I was talking about in Australia. It's like trying to like pick holes in the official arguments about the safety, because the holes are massive. The holes are absolutely enormous, and I can talk about some of those if you want to.
Yes, I would like for you to talk about the holes, but before then, I have another question, which is, we have not talked about how widespread GMOs are. Are they, you know, do GMOs at this point constitute 2% of the commercial corn? Do they constitute 70%? Do they constitute, what percentage of food crops, or no, not food crops, what percentage of, well, whatever, however you want to answer that. What is the ubiquity of it at this point?
Yeah. So it very much depends where you are. So in the U.S., it's approaching 100%, very close to 100% of all corn grown, unless it's organic corn. It's approaching 100% of all soybeans, unless they're organic soybeans. It is approaching 100% of all sugar beet, approaching 100% of all canola, and then a significant proportion of alfalfa, of cotton. And so those would probably be the main crops. It's 0%. The same number is reversed in Europe, for example. In Europe, it's 0% of any crop. No, nobody, basically, apart from a few tiny pockets of, in Spain, where things have gone badly for reasons we can talk about. There's virtually no GMOs grown. If you, and then other countries around the world vary radically, like China grows GMO cotton, but no GMO food crops, basically. I think they have a papaya. That's the only one. And in most other countries of the world, few or no GMO crops are grown. I was just in Australia. They grow GMO canola, and they grow GMO cotton. But that is all. Like, there's no wheat grown anywhere that is GMO. There's no rice grown anywhere that is GMO. So the answer to that question varies an awful lot. But, you know, the United States, Brazil, and Argentina are the ground zeros, if you like, of these crops.
Thank you. So what were the other concerns that you wanted to talk about?
The other big, you know, there's basically two products, right? You've got to understand this. There are basically two products. One is these insecticidal proteins. These are toxins. They kill insects, minimally insects, but also probably plenty of other things too. But we don't really have that great information about that. So that's at this point is an open question. What effect it has on pigs and people and so forth. There's a lot of concerning data, but there's not really proof at this point. There is, like I said, there's plenty of reasons to be worried about it. You know, based on simple experiments that people have done, you know, there's an article on our website about how regulators in Europe flagged up toxicological or apparent toxicological consequences of one of these crops being grown in experimental animals. And basically, the sort of top-level regulator basically blew off the concerns of the, you know, the French delegate, the French, basically the way the European Union organizes its safety systems around GMOs is that there's a sort of European-level regulator called EFSA, European Food Safety Authority, and they have to consult with national committees in before they promulgate a decision to approve or disapprove a GMO. So a whole load of countries, Belgium, France, Austria, objected to the approval of a GMO. But the top level regulator basically blew them off and said, we're not worried about this. But clearly there were reasons for concern of the kind that I'm talking about. These are, you know, rigorous scientific experiments that show that the organisms fed these GMOs had issues with their kidneys. So this is the kind of concern that I have, is that there is a whole bunch of evidence out there that is basically being ignored by the regulator. So this is one instead of issues. It's like, what is basically, these are toxins. They make holes in membranes. All organisms have membranes. Therefore, you should be worried about these toxins in your stomach, if they get into your bloodstream, if they get into your baby's blood. You know, they've been found in fetuses. They've been found in all kinds of interesting places. So these toxins are a concern. The other major product of the biotech industry is herbicide-tolerant crops. So if you go to a GMO cornfield or a GMO cotton field or a GMO alfalfa field, what will be grown there is a crop that is resistant to, it will basically have two traits. It was likely to have this insect resistance, and it's likely to have tolerance to a herbicide. So those herbicides, the herbicides for which there are tolerant crops are Roundup, which is glyphosate, glufosinate, dicamba, 2,4-D, and that's probably, I'm struggling to think of any others, but there's basically a large number of them are resistant to herbicides. The point of them being resistant to herbicides is that it allows, in principle, the good side of it is it allows farmers to be flexible about when they spray their herbicide, so that in principle they could actually spray less herbicide because they could wait and see if they have a weed problem before they spray. The downside is that it means that a herbicide can be sprayed onto your food crops while they're, you know, mid-season or even late season, while they're being grown. And that means that if a farmer does that, your exposure to those herbicides is going to be higher than it would have been. Because previously farmers were limited. They could only spray herbicides in for most crops, not for everyone, but for many, many crops. They could only spray the herbicide on at the beginning of the season. So it had to be on the bare soil. They had to deal with the weeds, you know, through cultivation methods. They have limited choices about how to deal with weeds that grew up on the crop during the season. What GMOs have allowed is this massive increase in the spraying of herbicides, because farmers at first made use of the flexibility and they would spray once in the middle of the season. But what happened then was that weeds became resistant. So they end up spraying more and more and more because the weeds are becoming more and more resistant and they don't necessarily know it. And now we have a new generations of GMOs that are resistant to multiple herbicides. So you can buy crops that are resistant to Roundup and dicamba and 2,4-D. And what that means is farmer sprays a whole tank mix of each of these three different herbicides onto the crop during the course of the season. And what that means is that you as a consumer, you know, if you eat the corn, for example, you eat the soybeans that has had this done to it, your exposure to these herbicides is much greater than what it would have been 20 years ago before these crops existed. So not only are you being exposed to the herbicide, you're also sometimes being exposed to breakdown products as well. And many of these breakdown products exist uniquely in those GMO crops, because when you ask yourself the question, how did the company organize it so that those crops were resistant to the herbicide? Sometimes it's because it's probably too complicated to go into, but there's a whole set of different ways in which a crop can have DNA introduced into it that makes it resistant to the herbicide. But one of them is to put into the crop an enzyme that breaks down the herbicide. But then you have to ask the question, what happens to the breakdown product of that herbicide? And in the case of glufosinate, for example, which is a, you know, highly dangerous neurotoxin, the breakdown product is another compound very closely related to that, but which isn't degraded inside the crop. So that whatever you spray and the glufosinate is turned into remains in the crop for the rest of the season. So the exposure of the population to herbicides is going through an evolutionary step change of massive amounts more being sprayed. The massive amount is being sprayed on the crop itself, and then the population is being exposed to all kinds of different breakdown products and so on and so forth. So you've got this whole accumulation of exposures that are going on that have, you know, radically increased in the last 20 or 25 years, and it continues to increase every single year as we go through.
You know, I sometimes despair at the possibility of human sentience. I'm kind of making a joke, but it just seems to me a profoundly... It seems to me that if you look from the outside and you dropped off the ideological inculcation that would allow people to maximize profits over everything else, it just seems to me that it's a really bad idea to intentionally bathe much of the planet in neurotoxins.
Mm-hmm.
That just seems like generically, if you're going to make a list of the top 10 things that you did not want to do, that seemed like a bad idea. I mean, one of the things I used to ask rhetorically is, who's the idiot who came up with the idea of putting neurotoxins on our own food? And I mean, just take that wherever you want, or not if you don't.
Yeah. No, I understand, but you know, it's boggling, absolutely boggling. And the part that interests me, you know, that you interviewed me about the poison papers a couple of months back, and the part that interests me as much as anything is, you know, there are some people who are consenting to all this who are not actually making any money really out of it. There are people who are scientists, for example, who sit on these regulatory committees and who make no money out of it. They merely okay all this, right? They have these people are in regulatory positions where they could just say, this is stupid and I'm not going to agree to this, and so our committee is not going to agree to this, and that will be the end of it, right? There are people who are at the very pointy end of this who have that power, right? You know, nominally we have a scientific approval system, and these people could make those decisions, and those are the people who interest me the most. Like, I understand why people who are, you know, whose jobs depend on it, who make the money that you know, the fine salaries that you get if you work for Dow and Monsanto and so forth. I understand why those people might do it. You know, I think, you know, I wouldn't do it. I don't work for those companies. It never occurred to me to work for those companies. But to me, the more mystifying part is those scientists, right? The regulators who decide that this somehow makes sense.
So, you said that's something that very much interests you. Do you want to talk about that more? Mm-hmm. Because that is, you know, I was just talking with a friend of mine over the last weekend about the timber industry and how the timber industry has captured the Forest Service and has captured California Department of Fire. California Department of Forestry, how increasingly industry takes over, like fish and wildlife and fish and game departments, and how he calls that, and he's called this for 30 years, he calls that sort of the natural history of a regulatory agency, which includes its capture by industry. I mean, do you want to take that anywhere?
Yeah, for sure. You know, what I don't call it regulatory capture. The word that we use for it is proactive collusion. And the reason why we use that word is because those, you know, the people who agree to this, like you say, they're in the Fish and Wildlife Service, they're in the EPA, they're in the FDA, they're in the USDA, they're in all these different government departments. And what they... You know, the way that I think about this is that, you know, there's a history of the idea of regulatory capture. I don't know if you know this, but regulatory capture was invented by Chicago economists in the 1950s. They were extremely right-wing economists. And what they wanted to do was basically confront the idea of regulation and basically argue that regulation is something that is impossible. And so therefore you shouldn't do it. And this is what, you know, this was their idea of how to go about that, to confront this idea and basically, you know, make the people who advocated for regulation, you know, throw up their hands. And But if you look at that idea, it's not very well defined. Like, what is happening? Is this an ongoing process, or is regulatory capture like an end product, or what intellectually is going on here? And so we've been looking at this a little bit, and because it becomes of interest, right? Like, how do you confront this collusion between the regulators, between the Wildlife Service and the timber industry, between EPA and the chemical industry, between the FDA and the pharmaceutical industry? Like, how do you confront that? And so then it becomes very, very important to understand exactly what is going on in these agencies. And the understanding we have is that people who work in these regulatory agencies, basically, they exist in this continual state of conflict of interest, in which if they stand up against these industries, they're likely to lose their job, right? They basically have to choose between confronting the industry and losing their job. And the reason is that if they confront the industry, what happens is that decision's going to have to be passed all the way to the top of that regulatory industry. You know, the Fish and Wildlife Service is going to tell some chemical company that they can't pollute this waterway, they can't endanger this species, they can't do whatever it is it needs doing, then that product will have to come off the market. There will be some kind of head-on collision in Washington, and somebody at the Fish and Wildlife Service, the head of Fish and Wildlife Service, presumably will be told, well, that's an unacceptable decision, you're going to have to back down here. And so that you have a situation in which these regulators refuse, you know, basically they can't go into these battles because they know they can't fight the chemical industry, they know they can't fight the banks, they know they can't fight the oil industry. And so what they do is they come up with strategies to collude, and the industry feeds them little arguments, and all these little arguments that are intended to basically make it impossible to produce a finding against their product. So they will feed them all these little strategies and suggestions, and that make it seem as though their collusion is not really collusion, it's merely logic, right? So you have these ideas like the dose makes the poison, or whatever. Like, this is something that the chemical industry repeats all the time, right? Well, there's many circumstances under which the dose doesn't make the poison, right? Different species, for example, are affected by the same amount of the poison in radically different ways. And we all know this as biologists, right? It's totally obvious. You know, you don't give chocolate to your dogs and animals. You know, cows die if you feed them yew berries and things, but you can eat those same berries and be fine. There's millions and millions of examples of this. But if they come up with these little trite phrases and these little trite sort of algorithms and these little trite understandings of how to go about their business, you know, as regulators, if they use these concepts, then the industry knows they'll get away with whatever it is they want to do. Because what they're feeding them is basically pseudoscience, but this pseudoscience enables the regulators, the Fish and Wildlife Service, the EPA, the FDA, to go about their business and apply these trite sentiments, if you like, or arguments, with a clean conscience. Right, because I've done the right thing, I've been scientific and I've said the dose makes the poison, therefore this product must be safe. Right? So they have there's a very sophisticated relationship that's going on between the regulator and the regulated company. And I saw this in Australia, right? So I went to Australia to talk about the cryotoxins that we wrote our paper about. And I went to the preeminent international meeting at which people, scientists, academics, discuss the questions that I raised at the beginning of this interview. They're basically, you know, why do we think that cryotoxins are going to make holes in some membranes and not other ones, and why is it safe for insects or unsafe for insects and safe for people, and so on and so forth. These are mechanistic scientific questions that at some level academics have to reconcile themselves with. So what happened at this meeting is that the Monsanto and Dow sponsored a pre-meeting. And at that pre-meeting, they invited themselves to speak, they invited other companies to speak, they invited some chosen academics to speak, and they also invited the regulator, the Australian, New Zealand food safety regulator, the people who actually have to make these decisions. The regulator showed up to this pre-meeting, right, which lasted most of the day. And they spent the whole time, they just sat there beaming away, you know, as if all was well with the world. I've come to a Monsanto to workshop to listen to the finest, you know, finest academic discussion of these toxins. But what was interesting about that regulator is they did not come to the rest of the academic meeting in which I spoke and other people spoke who had concerns about the nature of these cryotoxins and so forth, right? So the regulator is desperate to know, apparently, what Dow thinks, what Monsanto thinks, what BASF thinks, but they're not interested in what independent academics think, right? And that's because they cannot go, they know, they understand that they cannot stand up against these products, right? Because they will lose their job, right? They will, their agency may even cease to exist if they do that. And so they're stuck in this situation where they could confront the industry, but then they would have to be, you know, firstly, they'd have to be very smart. They'd have to do a lot of research. They'd have to think about stuff. They'd have to recruit allies in academia and so on and so forth. They would have to go about their business in a very wise and thoughtful and politically astute way. Or they can just parrot what Monsanto thinks, right? And they can, when they come up with their decision to approve this new product, all they have to do is cut and paste Monsanto's text into their own text. And have that be the regulatory decision, right? And this is what you see all the time. They cut and paste Monsanto's application and they make that the final basis of their decision. And then they don't have to worry themselves with, actually coming up with an independent view. That actually, if they actually came up with an independent view, might actually contradict in some marginal way the opinions of the companies who essentially they are beholden to on a political level. Does that all make sense?
Oh, it makes perfect sense. And we have just a couple minutes left, and I have two wind-down questions.
Hmm.
One of them is, what advice could you give to a young virologist or a young biologist of good heart who wants to go the right direction and also needs to pay the rent.
Mm-hmm.
And how, you know, basically, how have you been able to withstand the... How did you go the direction you did and that regulator you were talking about who was beaming at Monsanto go the direction they did? How, what's the difference? How can we make it so more people follow your direction? Mm-hmm. And the second one is, I know we only have like 2 minutes. Second one is, what final words do you have for the listeners on, GMOs?
Mm. I mean, Confucius' advice, if you want to serve the public interest, is to be indifferent to material pleasure, right? If you want to work for the government, there's always going to be people who are trying to get you to do one thing and not another and have, you know, want you to basically, to be corrupt, right? And you basically have to not worry about that, and you have to be prepared to lose your job, right? That is the bottom line here. Because science has become incredibly corrupt, and that situation is only getting worse. And so you have to understand that when you get into this, even though the whole idea of science is supposed to be that scientists are objective and independent and are not swayed by emotions and so on and so forth, that whole idea is totally bogus. Yet scientists are swayed by money and ethical issues and fear and so all these other emotional things, as people in any other profession. And so you have to understand that is the nature of the beast that you're getting into. You have a corpus of people, researchers, who believe themselves and tell each other and everybody who will listen that they are independent and indifferent to material pleasures and so on and so forth, when the opposite is true. Like, and that is the worst possible situation, because Because, you know, at least in many other professions, you know, at least a company, if you go to a company, everybody says, well, we're just in it for ourselves. We're in it, we're here for the money, we're in it for ourselves, we're not really doing this for the public interest. So at the end of the day, that's not the, our logic. So, but the scientific profession is so dangerous because it still believes in this whole ideology. And if they didn't believe in that ideology, by the way, and if everybody came out and said, well, we're just swayed by the money and we just do whatever people tell us and, you know, if you threaten us with our jobs, we'll keep quiet and so on and so forth, science would lose its whole aura, right? The whole purpose of science would disappear because no one would believe what scientists say because scientists now say that they're swayed by the money and they're influenced by the pressures that are put on them. And so this is necessary for the existence of science to have this mythology. So you have to understand that the mythology is a myth and you have to get past that. And you have to realize that this is how everybody is, everybody in the scientific community is operating.
And very, very quickly, final words, that's really great, thank you. And final words on GMOs.
I mean, I've told, you know, a lot of the story, really. You know, they're not needed to feed the world. This is the big thing, you know, the argument that I haven't mentioned, is that you don't need GMOs to feed the world. Small farmers, local farmers, organic production, regenerative agriculture, these things can feed the world. In fact, they do already feed the world. Most GMO agriculture is merely used for biofuel or it's fed to animals. That's all that's done with it. And it's not necessary to feed the world. And so the whole narrative of GMOs, that we need this high technology, intensive approach to produce, to avoid people starving, this story is basically false.
Well, thank you so much for all of that. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Jonathan Latham. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.